watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In last week's reading of John Taylor Gatto's History of Compulsory Schooling in America, we heard about a planned program of Americanization, in which compulsory schooling played a key role. The schooling we've all received has been part of a long-term effort by America's industrial elite to mass-produce people and culture in an attempt to create an ideal population of compliant workers and predictable consumers. Gatto has documented the various figures and organizations that planned, advocated, and implemented this social engineering. Its goal is to maintain a class system at home and an empire abroad that facilitates wealth accumulation for an economic nobility, and has, among other things, deployed racism as a tactic of dividing and conquering the population, as well as justifying violent conquest with theories of racial superiority based on pseudoscience. Part of that engineering involves inculcating in us a sanitized history about our country and its role in the world. We, the products of the American school system, have all been subject to this indoctrination, another part of which is the belief, shown in the oft-repeated claim, that America is the freest country in the world. I've heard people say this who I know have never lived in any other country. The success of this program of indoctrination can be gauged by the fact that there are any people at all willing to accept a statement such as that made by George Bush, that America is hated because of its freedom. Freedom is not like oil, a commodity with a finite supply and a specific geographic distribution. Freedom is available to any who arrange their society in such a way as to make it manifest. Or at least that's theoretically the case. The suppressed history of the U.S. that we're not taught is how it has, by force and violence, prevented others from manifesting that freedom in their societies. As well, our education has steered us away from an analysis of how freedom has been conceptualized and implemented in our own society. What do I mean by freedom? Freedom has been defined in many, often contradictory ways, but as a basic concept, I mean by freedom the absence of control and coercion by others, as well as the ability to meet one's needs for physical and psychological well-being. As the latter involves interacting with others, it necessarily creates a tension with the former. Freedom is very much in the eye of the beholder. In America, as well as in any capitalist country, freedom is for sale. Those bumper stickers one sees that say freedom isn't free are quite correct. The more wealth you have, the more freedom you can get. Monetizing freedom thus transfers it from plenty to scarcity and makes it, just like wealth and poverty, a zero-sum game. The goal of American foreign policy is to extend this system of unequal freedom everywhere by any means necessary. Increasing your freedom in this manner means decreasing someone else's. American slaveholders actually made the argument that their ability to enslave others was part of their freedom to own property. It gave them great freedom at the expense of those who were their slaves. The slaveholders were free men in an unfree society. This concept of freedom is what was institutionalized in the founding of the American state and has been practiced to various degrees ever since, a society of unequal freedom doled out on a sliding scale. The managers of the American state have persistently worked to extend this freedom everywhere, generation after generation, by any means necessary. How does this freedom look when it's extended everywhere? The United Fruit Company, now known as Chiquita Banana, once owned a nice big piece of freedom, large tracts of land in Guatemala, where it was able to hire local people to work in brutal conditions for a wage that maintained them in perpetual poverty, in order that the fruit could be exported and sold at a great profit. When the Guatemalans successfully elected a government that was going to increase the freedom of Guatemalans by allowing them to profit from farming the land themselves, the U.S. government acted to protect the freedom of Chiquita by overthrowing the Arbenz government and installing a dictatorship that was also willing to protect Chiquita's freedom, to the detriment of the freedom of those in Guatemala. Move then to Nigeria, on the other side of the world, where the Ogoni people desired only to exercise their freedom to draw water and fish in the rivers of their ancestral homeland. This was not to be, because American oil companies wished to extract oil from beneath the Ogonis' land, and a U.S.-backed Nigerian government assiduously protected the freedom of the oil companies to poison the Ogonis' waterways and to take away oil and profits to be shared between the oil companies and their Nigerian proxies. Iraq has been brought a similar freedom, but many in Iraq are fighting against this freedom because they don't like our freedoms. Last fall, American voters mobilized to elect a new Congress to put an end to a long-planned and partially implemented series of invasions of resource-rich nations, carried forward under a rubric of bogus national defense claims, mushroom clouds, WMD, etc. This Congress last week betrayed their promise to the voters to put a stop to this, offering instead meaningless legislation instead of acting decisively to break the power of the president to continue his course of invasions. The Congress has repeatedly refused to deploy their most formidable weapon, impeachment, which could be brought legally on grounds far more legitimate than that of extramarital sexual escapades between consenting adults. How can one conclude anything other than they are, as a group, down with the program, notwithstanding a few dissenting individuals within their ranks who denounce the bogus funding legislation and refuse to vote for it? Ironically, those dissenters found themselves, in terms of the vote, in the company of pro-war Republicans, their most extreme ideological opponents. I can only see the whole thing set up as a double bind, a lose-lose situation that does nothing to change the present course, whether you vote yes or no. Ironically, the pro-war Republicans who voted against the bill because it contained language setting a timetable for troop withdrawal from Iraq posed a bigger impediment to the prosecution of the war by failing to allow the funding to go through. Meanwhile, various foreign press sources are reporting on imminent plans to attack Iran sometime this month, perhaps as early as this coming Friday of the Easter weekend. This has not been covered in the American corporate press, which is focused on reporting administration denials of attack and on the drama of the captured British sailors, though it failed to pay equal attention to the preceding kidnapping of Iranian diplomats in Iraq. The Chinese and Japanese could stop the invasion cold by dumping their dollar reserves, plunging the U.S. economy into chaos, but don't think it's worth their while, apparently, because it doesn't impact the freedoms of their rich men. And preventing the murder of a bunch of Iranians, just as the murder of a bunch of Iraqis, just as the murder of a bunch of Afghanis, is of no importance. Therefore, I asked myself what programming I should present to you at such a time. And I decided upon another lecture from John Marciano's series, Empire as a Way of Life. It seemed most appropriate to understanding the present situation. I dedicate it especially to those sincere Americans who want to end this brutal world order, but who have not yet confronted, in my view, the barriers the American political party system places in the way of accomplishing this, and as well, the system of ideological indoctrination that allows this party system to remain essentially unchallenged from within. Some have hoped for help from the United Nations in this effort, but it has proved itself as ever useless in its main appointed task, the prevention of wars of aggression, as it is not able to be better than the sum of its component nation states. John Marciano's public classes also illuminate by example the critique John Taylor Gatto has been advancing of the education system, and readings from his book will continue in the latter part of the program. John Marciano is a retired professor who taught at SUNY Cortland for decades. He once mentioned how much he prefers teaching these classes. The way they work is each year the class centers around the reading and understanding of a significant work on American history and politics. Over the course of the year, the students read chapters of the book and related articles assigned by Marciano, then meet once a month for a lecture by him on the material, followed by class discussion. It costs no money to attend, and there are no tests or grades. Education is the sole purpose of the meetings. Marciano once commented how refreshing it was to teach students who engaged the learning process with enthusiasm, in contrast to his experience at SUNY Cortland, where assignments were often greeted with questions as to whether assigned readings would be included on a test, the implication being that if they were not, there was little point in doing the reading. This highlights the degree to which established institutions supposedly devoted to education are in fact focused on culling and sorting people to determine what place in society they will be allowed to occupy, a main theme in Gatto's work. So let's begin with Professor John Marciano and his class on empire as a way of life.
In the following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
Okay, we're going to finish William Appleman Williams, except for the last chapter, which we're going to get to at the end in June. The discussion of the second half of William Appleman Williams' Empire as a Way of Life will include insights from Chalmers Johnson's Sorrows of Empire, Felix Green's powerful critique of U.S. imperialism from the enemy, and Noam Chomsky's analysis of Cold War policies in Towards a New Cold War, among others. I will concentrate, however, on the World War II and Cold War empire policies of liberal democratic presidents Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. Williams argues that the process of transforming the realities of expansion, conquest, and intervention into pious rhetoric about virtue, wealth, and democracy reached its culmination during the decades after World War II. critical to our imperial self-deception, our surrender to doctrine, was National Security Council Document 68 of 1950, in which the United States asserted the unique right and responsibility to impose its chosen order among nations so that our free society can flourish. The NSC 68 authors presented the Cold War as the fulfillment or destruction not only of this republic, but of civilization itself. What humility. NSC 68 was, in Williams' view, the defining historical document of the Cold War era. Released in April 1950, its primary authors were two key members of the capitalist ruling class, Paul Nitze, former investment banker and head of the policy planning staff of the State Department, and Robert Lovett, investment banker who had been appointed Assistant Secretary of Defense. A key premise of NSC 68 was that other countries were to complement American objectives. This meant building a global world order harmonious with U.S. fundamental national purposes, a world environment in which the American system can survive and flourish. Translated into plain English, this meant a world in which U.S. interests, as defined by our ruling elite, prevail. The authors advocated a new world order to replace that which existed prior to World War II, and they recognized that even if there were no Soviet Union, we would face the great problem that the absence of order among nations is becoming less and less tolerable. Order in the interest of ruling elites has been fundamental to the nature of empire, and after World War II, the real fear of elites here has been revolutionary nationalism and independence in the Third World, not the USSR. Williams believes that NSC 68 is one of the truly imperial documents in the long tradition of Western European expansion around the world. He is right, and it is critical to understanding U.S. imperialism after World War II. It provides the benchmark for American foreign policies from April 1950 to our own time. Noam Chomsky's critical analysis of NSC 68 is found in his book, Towards a New Cold War, U.S. Foreign Policy from Vietnam to Reagan. Chomsky points to the serious problems facing the United States economy after World War II as the context for this document and its proposed policies. These problems included the fear of another depression and a special concern about an independent course in Western Europe. One critic called the latter, this independent course in Western Europe, a nightmare for U.S. policymakers. These fueled NSC 68's call for a vast militarization of the economy and the need for rapid and sustained buildup of the political, economic, and military strength of the free world. The free world, of course, is that part of the world open to penetration and control by U.S. corporations. The freedom the document advocated would allow the U.S. governmental and corporate class to dominate the economic and political systems of other nations. It had nothing to do with our common sense notion of freedom. Chomsky continues, the exaggeration of the Soviet threat reached almost hysterical proportions, even though the authors simultaneously recognized fundamental Soviet economic and military weakness, a contradiction that is never explained by mainstream apologists of U.S. imperialism. The document sought to overcome U.S. domestic economic problems by the familiar device of military Keynesianism, what FDR used to end the Great Depression, with special attention, in one analyst's words, to overcoming Western Europe's tendency to pursue an independent economic course by binding Western Europe to the United States with military ties. This independent economic development might close off opportunities to U.S. capitalism. NSC urged the U.S. to foster a world environment in which the American, that is, capitalist system, can survive and flourish. This would not be difficult given U.S. moral leadership in the world. As the author stated, the essential tolerance of our world outlook, our generous and constructive impulses, and the absence of covetousness in our international relations are assets of potentially enormous influence. Chomsky adds, Or, we might add, would be so if we could only somehow overcome the blindness of Latin Americans and others who, in their absurd and obtuse delusions, fail to perceive these fundamental elements of U.S. policies and actions. According to Chomsky, NSC 68 was a proposal awaiting the opportune moment for enactment that was provided by the Korean War. Its language was similar to the Resurgent America program of the Reagan administration, both in the manipulation of the alleged Soviet drive for world domination and in the real domestic and international goals concealed by Cold War imagery and rhetoric. Chomsky goes on to say, a decade later, the Kennedy administration moved to use similar rhetoric and programs, and their affinity to the Reagan programs of militarization and international confrontation and aggressiveness is striking. Let's return a moment to William's discussion of the benevolent and progressive policeman, I love that phrase, who is part of the self-image of empire. The real challenge to U.S. benevolence, he asserts, has always been the threat to the capitalist system posed by revolutionary nationalism, because any contracting out of the global marketplace threatened both the theory and practice of capitalism. The fundamental target after World War II, therefore, was not the former Soviet Union, but third world movements that would take those nations out of the global capitalist order. William's discussion of FDR's presidency is critical to his thesis on empire and a needed corrective to the largely positive view many liberals and leftists have of the New Deal. While it is true that the Great Depression left a deep psychological impact in the U.S., Williams is right that FDR's New Deal did not generate peacetime recovery, as the economy was revived only through World War II. The massive state subsidies generated by the war ended the Great Depression, not New Deal reforms. In Williams' view, Roosevelt actually strengthened the imperialist state. He steadily increased military spending and reinforced the power of giant corporations as power became more consolidated and centralized. And World War II, according to Williams, was a grand illusion predicated upon a failure to comprehend the full meaning of the Great Depression and grounded in the belief that the U.S. could reap the rewards of empire without paying the cost and without admitting that it was an empire. The centralization of power and imperialism that unfolded under FDR continued under Harry Truman, often portrayed as a liberal, anti-corporate political figure. Effective political power was more narrowly concentrated in the alliance of economic giants and the government that had been created during the Depression and the war, leaving citizens reduced to saying yes or no to choices defined and presented by others. Truman was a Wilsonian in his imperial foreign policies who believed the United States had to be aggressive in getting exports and raw materials and relevant financial arrangements in order to ensure prosperity at home. An old argument. He and his advisors were hardliners during the Cold War and not responsive to any indications that the Soviets were interested in a peaceful settlement of the conflict. William's argument here that the United States was a major force in starting and deepening the Cold War is the thesis put forth by historian D.F. Fleming in his seminal two-volume history of the period. Williams believes the Korean War finally brought the empire to bay, causing Eisenhower to confront the essential truth about its ultimate costs. Ike clearly understood the inherent dangers of imperial policies, and in his 1961 farewell address, he spoke candidly and forcefully about the military-industrial complex that had become the axis of the American political economy. This complex is vastly more powerful today. Eisenhower's concern was ignored, however, when Kennedy and the best and the brightest empire managers took over. Williams views them as militant advocates of the global imperial way of life who quickly reasserted their power and policy of policing the world in the name of benevolent progress. The New Frontier Gang perfectly express the psychopathology of the empire at bay and its consequences. Now, we will examine Kennedy's militarist and imperialist policies when we discuss Greg Grandin's book on Latin America. Williams tells us that the rhetoric became more apocalyptic, and Kennedy began a massive military buildup in the spirit of NSC 68. Even though the United States enjoyed a massive superiority in strategic weapons, he publicly goaded, even insulted, the Soviet Union by gloating about its gross inferiority. In the early stages of the Kennedy presidency, the USSR had 4 operational nuclear missiles. The United States had some 20,000 nuclear warheads and 300 missiles. These and other facts ought to put to rest the lies used by Kennedy and his advisors that Eisenhower and Nixon, imagine that, Eisenhower and Nixon had allowed the United States to fall dangerously behind the Soviet Union in nuclear capability, one of the biggest scams of U.S. history. Kennedy's actions, according to Williams, scared the Russians and very probably led to the confrontation in 1962 over Russian missiles in Cuba. I believe Williams' assertion is wrong. The true context for the Cuban Missile Crisis is to be found in the terrorist acts against Cuba by the United States that eventually forced the USSR to arm that nation against a possible invasion from the imperial giant to the north. Williams sympathizes with President Johnson's brave and, in the end, tragic effort to rescue the contradiction in the imperial way of life. He tried to make major improvements in the quality of life for the poor and also secure the frontier in Indochina. He couldn't do both because the dynamics of empire left him no room for maneuver. U.S. imperialism, I would suggest, does not leave room for guns and butter. Each time that choice has been decided in favor of militarism that left domestic human needs to wither on the vine. Williams asks us whether the idea and reality of America is possible without empire. The short answer is no. Capitalist USA and empire go hand in hand. We cannot end one without ending the other. He continues, are we unable to share the world on an equitable basis? Again, no. There's not a snowball's chance in hell, given that this system feeds on endless growth and expansion and is built on a foundation of inequality. He asks yet another profound question. Is it possible to create and sustain a democratic culture without conquering or otherwise controlling and wasting a grossly inequitable share of social space and resources? Again, the answer is no. It cannot be done within the structural realities of a capitalist and imperialist system. I would like to begin our critical look at Williams with some insights from Chalmers Johnson's fine book, The Sorrows of Empire. Johnson, professor emeritus at the University of California at San Diego, a Japan scholar, and a former CIA consultant during the Vietnam War, offers a powerful analysis of the origins and true costs of our empire. Johnson's first major assertion is that most Americans do not recognize or do not want to recognize that the U.S. dominates the world through its military power. Due to government secrecy, they are often ignorant of the fact that their government garrisons the globe. They do not realize that a vast network of American military bases on every continent except Antarctica actually constitutes a new form of empire. An important aspect of this empire is that the Central Intelligence Agency has evolved into the president's private army to be used on secret projects, as, for example, in Nicaragua and Afghanistan in the 1980s. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Johnson fears that this militarism, arrogance of power, and euphemisms required to justify imperialism inevitably conflict with America's democratic structure of government and distort its cultural and basic values, that as this happens, the Republic will be destroyed. The U.S. empire, in his view, has grown to the point where it staggers the imagination. It supports a military-industrial complex, university research and development contracts, petrochemical refineries and distributors, innumerable foreign countries with whom it has treaties, multinational corporations and the cheap labor they use to make their products, investment banks and speculators of all varieties, and advocates of globalization. The catchword that really means forcing all nations to open themselves up to American exploitation and American-style capitalism. Despite this complex and long imperialist history, Johnson claims we have a long-standing urge to find euphemisms that soften and disguise the U.S. version. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, professed to be not an imperialist, but an expansionist. Arguing for the annexation of the Philippines, he said, there is not an imperialist in the country. Expansion, yes. Expansion has been the law of our nation's growth. He was right. Just reread Roxanne Dunbar's fine article on U.S. imperialism to see the historical evidence for this law. In his discussion of the links between the Cold War and empire, Johnson claims that the former allowed the U.S. to grab a number of lands that were defended or liberated during World War II. In 1953, for example, the United States secretly forced part of the indigenous population of Greenland, a Danish colony since 1721, to move. It gave them 4 days' notice and threatened to bulldoze their homes in order to make way for a vast expansion of Thule Air Force Base, 234,000 acres, disguised since World War II as a weather station. Despite protests by the Inuit of Greenland and numerous lawsuits filed in the Danish Supreme Court, the U.S. remains in control of this base. For Johnson, the liberal Woodrow Wilson remains the godfather of those contemporary ideologists who justify American imperial power in terms of exporting democracy. Wilson stated, "The world must be made safe for democracy. America," he explained, "must fight for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right by such a concert of free persons as shall bring peace last free." According to Wilson, these were the pursuits we have always carried nearest to our hearts. What a guy. Grandin, in his book, details the historical record of Wilson's relentless imperialist aggression in Latin America, revealing the utter bankruptcy of the latter's claims that he was concerned about the fate of small nations. We'll get to that in February and March. Beginning with the Korean War, Chalmers Johnson tells us, the empire became institutionalized as huge military expenses fundamentally altered the political economy of the country. Staggering levels of military spending became a normal feature of civilization, and all members of Congress, regardless of political affiliation, tried to attract military contracts to their districts. Regions such as our own Southern California became dependent on military expenditures. By 2002, it was estimated that the Pentagon funneled nearly a quarter of its research and development funds to companies in California alone, a subsidy to major corporations that would have caused a catastrophic collapse of the state's economy had it been removed. The empire, with its Pentagon capitalism, turned Japan and Korea into political satellites in the late 1940s and paid off client regimes to keep them docile and loyal. Essentially, this means paying off the ruling elites in those nations to keep their own citizens in line. He continues, we have taught state terrorism to thousands of Latin American military and political officials at the Army's School of the Americas and utilized the CIA and the International Monetary Fund to bring about regime changes via coups, assassinations, or economic destabilizations, and have bombed or invaded countries that have openly broken with or opposed our hegemony. In pursuing these imperialist policies, Johnson argues, the most powerful tool of the Pentagon in promoting its image and protecting its interests from public scrutiny is official secrecy, the so-called black programs paid for through the black budget. This systematic effort to confuse and spread disinformation began during World War II with the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb. Since the beginning of the Cold War, the Pentagon has become addicted to a black budget way of life. All funds for the CIA were and still are secretly contained in the War Department's public budget under camouflage names. I like the use of the War Department rather than the Department of Defense. It was called the War Department until 1947. As the President, the Pentagon, and the CIA create new intelligence agencies, the black box expands exponentially. For example, in 1952, President Truman signed a still-secret charter creating the National Security Agency. In 1960, President Eisenhower set up the even more secret National Reconnaissance Office, which runs our spy satellites. In 1961, President Kennedy launched the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the personal intelligence organization of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of War. And in 1966, President Clinton combined several agencies into the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. The budgets of these ever-proliferating agencies are all unpublished and have not been challenged by either party since the creation of the National Security State in 1947. Despite the realities of imperialist aggression since World War II, built upon a massive foundation of taxpayer funds for overt and covert policies, the essential nature of the entire empire project must be kept hidden from U.S. citizens. Johnson points out that history tells us that an expansionist nation must at least attempt to disguise what it is doing if it wants to consolidate its gains. It must pretend that its exploitation of the weak is in their own best interest, or their own fault, or the result of ineluctable processes beyond human control, or the consequences of the spread of civilization, or in accord with scientific laws. Anything and everything but the deliberate aggression by a hyperpower. While we can see the blatant imperialism of George W. Bush in Afghanistan and Iraq, Bill Clinton camouflaged his policies by carrying them out under the banner of globalization. The main agents of this imperialism were Clinton's Secretary of Treasury, Robert Rubin, and his deputy and former president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers. The U.S. ruled the world, but did so in a carefully masked way that produced high degrees of acquiescence among the dominated nations. Johnson asserts that globalization policies must be seen within the context of an imperialism that cannot exist without a powerful military apparatus for subduing and policing the peoples who stand in its way, and an economic system for financing an expensive and largely unproductive military establishment. He believes we need to examine the elaborate ideology of neoliberalism that has obscured America's international endeavors before the triumph of unilateral militarism, and to reveal how militarism has displaced and discredited America's economic leaders. It is in this economic sphere that the overstretched American empire will probably first begin to unravel. That's his thesis. This is similar to scholar Emmanuel Wallerstein's major argument. The U.S. empire is in decline because of serious economic contradictions that must be masked with unilateral and belligerent militarism. Johnson makes a critical point about the connection between empire abroad and the destruction of democracy at home. It is an absolutely critical point. Although tyranny, because it needs no conscience, may successfully rule over foreign peoples, it can stay in power only if it destroys, first of all, the national institutions of its own people. This will first begin with a state of perpetual war, leading to more terrorism against Americans. It will be followed by a loss of democracy and constitutional rights as the presidency fully eclipses Congress and is itself transformed from an executive branch of government into something more like a Pentagon presidency. Third, an already well-shredded principle of truthfulness will be increasingly displaced by a system of propaganda, disinformation, and a glorification of war, power, and the military legions. Last, there will be bankruptcy as we pour our economic resources into ever more grandiose military projects and shortchange the education, health, and safety of our fellow citizens. I would argue that anyone who has studied the U.S. empire carefully would have to agree with Johnson's accurate and chilling analysis. From the creation of the National Security State in 1947, the levels of lying, secrecy, and presidential power have continued to grow, aided by compliant and silent legislative and judicial branches. There are no checks on the endless war promoted by the empire, save for those that emerge from the people themselves, as we learned from the U.S. Vietnam War and the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We cannot count on our elected officials to mount any substantive challenge to the endless imperialist wars organized and promoted by Democratic and Republican presidents alike. As fine as Johnson's analysis of empire is, we must dig deeper yet to link U.S. imperialist aggression to the very premises and policies of 21st century corporate capitalism. In his introductory essay in his edited book, The New Imperialist, Colin Moores cautions us not to see the most recent U.S. imperialist actions under the current Bush regime solely in terms of a reaction to 9/11, or, more sinisterly, as the pre-planned goal of bellicose neoconservatives. It is true that this regime is more willing to resort to large-scale military interventions than previous administrations. However, to see this as a fundamental change in the nature of U.S. imperialism would be an exaggeration. The USA has a long an unbroken history of imperialist conquest stretching back more than two centuries. While America is still the preeminent military power on the planet, its superiority and firepower vastly exceeds its economic supremacy. It is this imbalance between economic and military might that helps account for the shift to a more aggressive military posture. That's Moore's argument. It's very much like Wallerstein's argument. Thus, the drive toward a more coercive orientation in international relationships is intended to send a message not only to the so-called rogue regimes and failed states, but also to its major economic competitors. Moores believes we need to understand the move to the new imperialism is linked to the deep structural shifts in global capitalism that have occurred over the past two decades. Shifts that are to be found in the neoliberal policies that truly emerged under Reagan and his successors, who attempted to address a persistent problem for capitalism, its tendency toward overcapacity and overaccumulation, an issue which is particularly acute for the U.S. economy. Driving this process was the need to locate new sites for capital accumulation and new markets for commodities. As discussed in Williams, this problem first emerged in the late 19th century and was clearly recognized by all of the major influential corporate and political leaders of that time. Moores believes we need to understand this latest and very belligerent phase of imperialism, therefore, in light of the goal of exporting and entrenching capitalist social property relationships throughout the world. It is about the universality of capitalism. And just as in earlier phases of capitalism, state military power has been central to the imposition of this new stage of primitive accumulation and enclosure. His conclusion, I would argue, is accurate and also distressing. We, and especially the victims of U.S. imperialism, face a more or less permanent state of warfare. War without end. This is necessary for the U.S. because its competitive struggle to dominate the global economy requires military action without end in purpose or time. In another essay in Moore's volume that complements and supports his thesis, historian Ellen Mixins Wood argues that the fully developed capitalist empire, which depends above all on economic imperialism, is basically the story of U.S. imperialism. Militarism is necessary in order to police the global system to make it safe for the movements of capital. Therefore, the first and most important objective in this new empire is free access for capitalism, and U.S. capitalism in particular, to anywhere in the world, what is euphemistically called openness. This free access to people and the earth has been obtained by the most violent means in order that exploitation by U.S. ruling interest will continue. In a previous class, I shared some insights from Felix Green's book, The Enemy, What Every American Should Know About Imperialism. I wish to add some of his other reflections to our discussions of Williams and empire. Green, writing in the early 1970s, I would argue his thesis is even more powerful today, argued that the U.S. had become the New World Colossus, the inheritor of inconceivable wealth and power. But, he asked, power to what ends, and where does the wealth go? Who controls this immense and complicated system? And is the U.S. using its new and extraordinary position to ameliorate poverty and injustices of the world? Or are we seeing only the latest of the long line of imperialists out only for themselves? Given the historical record, I would suggest that the answers to his questions are quite clear. Green argues that the maintenance of this imperialism became especially critical for the U.S. after World War II. In his view, therefore, the U.S. had to confront a number of immediate imperatives in order to save this system. One, it might be left as an isolated island in a world gone socialist, and thus capitalism could not survive as an island in a non-capitalist world. Therefore, the first survival imperative for U.S. rulers was to keep the existing capitalist world capitalist. Two, because of profits made during World War II, huge amounts of capital were accumulated in the hands of U.S. corporations. Capital cannot remain idle and will always go where it makes the largest profit. Therefore, it was imperative the U.S. invest surplus capital abroad where the largest profits could be made. Three, because of wartime expansion and the rapidity with which American industry reconverted its factories to civilian production, there was a growing unused industrial capacity. Therefore, another imperative was to find markets overseas for American goods. Four, in order to compete in the world market, it was necessary to obtain the prodigious amounts of raw materials at the lowest possible cost. Therefore, an imperative was to secure control over the sources of raw materials. Five, of course, in order to have access to the sources of raw materials and control over them, the U.S. had to have the capability physically to control those countries that supply them, thus necessitating the establishment of a global network of unchallenged military power. From the voluminous historical record, including D.F. Fleming's excellent history of the Cold War, that he traces back to the U.S.-led invasion of the newly founded Soviet Union in 1918, not 1945. We know exactly what U.S. ruling elites did after World War II to deal with each of the imperatives that Green listed above. Green concludes his critique of U.S. imperialism with a profound question. Why are the poor countries of the world still so poor? And by the way, the latest World Bank and UN statistics show that they're vastly poorer today in relation to the wealthy countries than they were in 1970. It strikes to the core of the imperialist dilemma that few in the U.S. wish to confront. He says, foreign investment has not helped the undeveloped countries because it is not intended to help them. It is intended to make profits for investors, which is a very different thing. He concludes with what he calls one of the grotesque paradoxes of our time. The backward countries are enormously rich. It is indeed because of their wealth that they are colonized. That's the argument of Eduardo Galeano in The Open Veins of Latin America. We shall leave the final word on empire tonight to the eminent British historian Arnold Toynbee. Writing in the 1970s, he stated, and I quote, America today is the leader of a worldwide anti-revolutionary movement in defense of vested interests. She now stands for what Rome stood for. Rome consistently supported the rich against the poor in all foreign communities that fell under her sway. And since the poor have always and everywhere been far more numerous than the rich, Rome's policy made for inequality, for injustice, and for the least happiness for the greatest number. Just substitute the U.S. for that. Let's take a break.
You're listening to John Marciano's public class series on Empire as a Way of Life. We'll continue with the discussion of Marciano in the class. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
So, and let's have more of a free-ranging discussion because I don't know how long my voice is going to last.
Okay, well, there's no mention in William's book of what might seem to be countervailing tendencies, such as the development of the United Nations. And there it looks like the United States is quite willing to give up at least some of its power by being a member of the Security Council, where power is shared with the other permanent members. And now I wonder how that gets included into your and William's analysis. Is it just something to be used as an imperial tool?
Because it's a good point. I don't know why he really didn't address that. I wouldn't call it much of a countervailing power. I mean, in terms of U.S. covert actions, and when we get into Grandin's book, post-World War II, and especially in Central and South America, the U.N. was essentially helpless to do anything about it, and the U.S. basically got to do what it wanted to do. Playing off of your question, even though he discusses the Soviet Union a little bit, I mean, it was the major countervailing power during the Cold War. I can't imagine the United States threatening Iran and going into Iraq twice if the Soviet Union were around. I mean, it would be inconceivable that the U.S. could do what it's been doing since 1991. Regardless of whatever we may think about the abysmal, terrible policies internally in the Soviet Union, and we could spend decades talking about them, the absolute crimes, etc., on the international arena, they were a check to the U.S. Because I think we have a sense now of what the U.S. can do in the world, militarily, not economically. But that certainly is a failure of the book. Williams has passed on. We don't have him around to find out why. Because there have been, within a number of agencies of the United Nations, certainly it has done some marvelous work. And I think potentially it's the only institution on the planet in which there's any hope of some kind of what we would call a real world order, not the kind of new world order that Bush's father talked about.
Point. That seemed to be the hope right after World War II as well. And the United States was very strong in promoting the United Nations. So what happened? I mean, maybe that tendency was overcome by imperialistic tendencies, perhaps afterward or latent all along, but it does look like a kind of counter tendency that emerged just for a moment at any rate.
Yeah, and think of the role of Eleanor Roosevelt in working for the UN Declaration on Human Rights, which was finally approved in 1948. It may not be a great institution, but it's the only one around that we've got to work with.
I think we should talk about the limits to American military power and economic power.
We found an
insurgency in Iraq has limited and tied up the most powerful army in the world, just as a small group of determined peasants with low-tech military equipment did in Vietnam. And we now have the empire crumbling in Latin America because the power of the United States is limited in terms of expressing its total hegemony over those regimes. And the people, the voters in those places, have been emboldened to the place where they're electing socialist, open socialist representatives.
In laying out a critique of imperialism and recognizing the power of the U.S., especially since 1945, I think we have to recognize what Brian has said. Even beginning in 1945, I mean, there's a resistance to the empire throughout the world. I'm just finishing now a book I've been meaning to read for a long time, more than 20 years, Seymour Hersh's book on Kissinger called The Price of Power. If there ever was a relentless journalist to equal Seymour Hersh in U.S. history, I don't know who it is, maybe I.F. Stone, but the long discussion in that book about Vietnam and this struggle of decades and decades, well, going back centuries against the Chinese, brought at an enormous cost, at an absolutely staggering cost, perhaps, I mean, I've seen estimates everywhere from 2.1 to 3.4 million Vietnamese killed, holding the United States, denying the United States an outright military victory, preceded, of course, by the other major post-World War II struggle in which the U.S. was involved before now, that is the Korean War, in which perhaps 3 million Koreans lost their lives, most of those in the North. I remember having a discussion with a friend, a colleague at the college where I taught, who had actually enlisted in the U.S. Army after high school and was a grunt. He was an infantryman in Korea, he said, and he was in what was now North Korea. He said there was absolutely not a single structure standing in just mile after mile and mile. They unleashed then the B-29s, and it was the most devastating, you know, bombing. But even with all of that, because of the entrance of the Chinese, the United States was forced to a stalemate, and in Vietnam. And there have been amazing developments, very surprising and amazing, in Latin America, given that the U.S. basically had a free hand for decades. Certainly things are going on, and you know they're trying to undermine and overthrow Chavez in Venezuela. But again, to go back to Hersh's book, he's got amazing detail of what the U.S. did to Chile. The U.S. does not have as free a hand today as it did in 1970 to 73 in what it did in Chile. And a final comment. I am just absolutely stunned that, at least on paper and certainly in reality, the most powerful technologically the most powerful military in the world cannot occupy and control two devastated countries. I mean, these are not major armies that the U.S. is up against. And if the U.S., if you were a believer in this system, you would wonder, what is going on? We have thousands of planes, hundreds of ships. We've got about 1,400,000 people in uniform. And remember, of the 140,000 or so official troops, you have to add about 100,000. I've seen estimates, 100,000 mercenaries, contractors. So U.S. has about 240,000. But of those troops, it's usually a ratio of 1 to 6 or 1 to 7. They're not all out in the field, even though they're more out in the field than were in Vietnam. When we had 541,000 troops in Vietnam, there were maybe 80,000 in actual combat because, you know, the people got to drive trucks, got to type memos, got to cook, etc. Now, that's all being farmed out. So there's amazing resistance in this country. I mean, the U.S. cannot even control the green zone in Baghdad. I mean, it's remarkable.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the antidote to capitalism and corporations and things like that?
Well, I think, I mean, the ending of capitalism and some kind of democratic, socialist, communal, ecologically sensitive society, to me, is the necessary but not sufficient condition in order to deal with not only the ability and power of, because it's not corporations as abstractions, but it's actual corporate officials making decisions, which they have been doing for a long time, but have become especially powerful after World War II. Whether it was Truman, who some of my family voted for Truman, my dad probably voted for Henry Wallace in 1948, but people were New Deal Democrats, and Truman was perceived as a give him hell Harry, fighting the corporate elite in the society, and supporting the people against the interest. Most of his major advisors were all Wall Street lawyers and investment bankers, so beginning with Clark Clifford, who stuck around to end up being Secretary of Defense War for Lyndon Johnson. So that the ability of a small class of people to make the fundamental decisions, whether it's over global warming, whether it's over women's rights, whether it's over racism, whether it's where we invest our money, how we invest our money, unless that's broken and we have both a substantive political democracy and a substantive economic democracy. Unless that's broken, I don't think you can break the empire. And I think Williams' argument, well, not Williams as much as Green and Chalmers Johnson, they're going to give us endless war.